Welcome back to another episode of Convergence. We take a deep dive into issues of culture and faith. As always, I'm joined by my good friend, Michelle McAloon.
Hello, good friend, Alan Taylor.
And she is in Germany, which ironically, you probably can see our next guest wave to him across the countryside.
There we go. Hello.
We are going to take a look at some issues of how we describe ourselves generationally and how those titles and labels we put on each other are actually harming us rather than hurting us, helping us, I should say. We bring in an expert. Dr. Andrew A. Michta is the Dean of the College of International Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Germany. The views presented are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies, the Department of Defense, or the United States government. Welcome, Doctor.
My pleasure. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great.
Dr. Michta, you wrote a very interesting article for National Review on the new revolutionary or counter-revolutionary, cultural revolutionary spirit of Generation Z. We need to talk to our audience about what is Generation Z? What are we looking at? What is that demographic?
It's really the demographic that's replacing the millennials as the young maturing men and women in America today. So these are the young men and women who are about to graduate from college. Basically, the bracket can run from 7 until about 23. They have not experienced the 2008 recession, you know, the meltdown of our economy. So they don't have the same experience as the millennials do, who think of themselves more as those who kind of failed to launch at a time when they were maturing. They are much more diverse when it comes to their ethnicity than the millennials even. And they are, like the millennials, the product of our higher educational system, as well as what happens at the elementary and high school level. So they are almost the kind of culmination going forward of the intersectionality slash identity politics slash you fill the blanks. And most importantly, I think they are much less grounded in American traditions and our history. In traditional Christian code of ethics and understanding greater connectivity to the country at large. I think in that sense, they're different. It's probably too early to judge what impact they will have because they're just entering really adulthood. They are to some extent constrained also like the millennials by the economic conditions. I mean, we suppressed the $23 trillion economy literally on a dime because of COVID. So they're going to be experiencing some of those economic dislocations that the millennials had, but for different reasons. I think they are increasingly going to be replacing the millennials within the next decade as they enter professional lives, and they'll shape our politics and our culture.
One thing the article lays out, really the base of our issues, is that in the past we were united, e pluribus unum. Now we seem to be divided by traits, by numerous other issues. How do we return to a cohesive society to make a cohesive generation? And is this really the bedrock issue of most of our problems going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I've written in several venues that the American national identity, what you call the pluribus unum, is being deconstructed effectively along group identity politics. And that takes place largely because of how our educational system, especially at the college level, but this now reaches all the way to elementary and high schools, has evolved. It's we are in the throes of what I call a neo-Marxist project that has been adapted to the conditions of America today. One of the greatest achievements of the United States historically has been the ability to create a community and nation with the reciprocity, mutuality of obligation that was grounded in some very fundamental concepts. The Christian tradition was one of them. the sense of American exceptionalism as that, you know, nation that was going to escape all the problems of the old continent and build a new world over here. I'm not trying to romanticize this. Of course, we had a lot of problems as a society developing, but we used to treat our educational system as a transmission belt to create a sense of a larger cohesive national identity. And in a country as vast as the U.S., it's a continental republic with the distances and the diversity of ethnic origins, racial origins, cultures, histories, and all of that, that ability until about the 1960s of acculturating all the immigrants coming in into that shared post-British American settler culture that was at the base of the American national identity, that has been largely dismantled. I am very deeply concerned that our young men and women, as they go through their educational processes, and they're very impressionable, they're developing, they're trying to gain acceptance of their peers, but most of all of their mentors in schools and in colleges, they're being pushed in the direction where they, number one, see our history with all its complexity and richness, but ultimately with all its positive messaging as essentially one gigantic narrative of oppression, of group grievance. That's what intersectionality is all about. And as a result, they enter adulthood not seeing this larger connectivity. And what you see is the breakdown of this e pluribus unum into this cacophony of different narratives. Samuel Huntington wrote a brilliant book several years ago, Who Are We? Where he essentially argued that this notion of the melting pot of a pluribus unum, right, as you mentioned it, used to underlie the foundation of American national identity. And that has been replaced with what Sam called the salad bowl approach, where you no longer acculturate and integrate the people, but that you have this diversity of delicious ingredients, but they never add up to one coherent narrative. That, from my perspective as a political scientist and somebody who's worked in security studies for over three decades, that's a prescription for disaster, because that's a prescription for the fracturing of the larger national narrative and the eventual, you know, kind of turning on each other and creating group categories, which are quintessentially non-American in the way how we think of politics, you know, individual liberty, under the law, that is the American narrative. The hierarchies of competences, the hierarchies of quality, merit, and achievement. Group categories essentially destroy that, and they insist that you judge people based on whether they belong to that or another group, and you build the hierarchies of those groups. That's a recipe for deconstruction of our identity. And I've been trying to fight against that for decades, both when I was still in academia and now as I work in the war college system and for the U.S. government.
Dr. Mikta, identity politics is ultimately about victimhood. And I wonder if what we're looking at with Generation Z is a shadow of 9/11. When, you know, if there is any correlation between our country being hit in 2001, I'm sorry, these people growing through that period or being born during that period. And now we have a wholesale group that wants to paint themselves as victims. And in that victim mentality, I wonder what it really portends for the future, because it's not just about identity politics, it's about seeing yourself as a victim rather than the rugged individual, which has always been the kind of the American persona, the American story.
If you use identity politics and group categories, then you try to build a hierarchy not based on individual achievement, but whether or not you can subscribe to an aggrieved group. The narrative and the experience of American Blacks is unique. Our history of slavery, this is a stain that we have been dealing with essentially for the entire duration of the Republic, even after the Civil War. This is part of our history that I believe we have made tremendous effort to overcome. What has happened, however, is that rather than trying to move beyond into this concept of individual merit and individual value, you know, the narrative of the Martin Luther King dream of the 1960s, judge me by the content of my character, not by the accidental features. We have absolutely no control over, you know, whether we are born with black skin or white skin or whatever racial or ethnic type we are. That is a completely accidental element. And yet we have fetishized this right now. And we're perpetuating among the young men and women the sense that if you can narrate yourself as a member of a victimized group, then you can extract benefits from society based on that, and you can build hierarchies based on that, and not necessarily based on your own achievement. This has really accelerated since the late 1980s, when you know all the talk about essentially intersectionality as a theory of a very complex set, but of basically victimhood relationships, and the hierarchies built around began to dominate academia. Remember that most of our young men and women are exposed largely to that narrative. There are very few colleges and universities today that would teach traditional curriculum. I was at Stanford in 87, 88, when the great books curriculum was abolished. You know, the Western culture's got to go, hey ho, hey ho. Mm-hmm. And what has happened, instead of us passing on our tradition, the greatest works of Western culture and civilization, beginning with the Bible, looking on the, of the greatest philosophy that we have built our entire political structure on, we have started serving our young men and women essentially marginal texts that have very little to do not only with our own political tradition, but also with real cultures of other nations and other peoples. So they lack that foundation on which to build. They're being told that there is no such thing as a binary right or wrong, good or bad, accurate or inaccurate, because everything is supposed to be deconstructed, quote unquote, that there is no real meaning in the text, it's all created. You take a young man and woman at the age of 19, 18, entering college, I sometimes jokingly call them 13th graders coming into universities. They're out of their family environment for the first time in most cases, and they're exposed to that kind of narrative. I've watched firsthand. I spent 20 some years teaching as a university college professor, and I was watching the transformation that occurs usually around the sophomore year, and definitely by junior year. And what happens quite often, young men and women who leave their families, go to study, their parents make great sacrifices. If you think about what private tuition costs right now, it's about $250,000 investment into a four-year college. They lose their children in the end, in the sense that the values and reference points that we have, you know, their parents' generation, no longer resonate with their children. We stopped teaching civics, you know, basically in the 1970s. I had, in my intro to international relations classes, I would have, you know, students who never read the Federalist Papers, who had no idea about the basic texts, simply because that wasn't taught. It's a very serious problem. And the issue is that faculties at colleges and universities perpetuate themselves. You know, the hiring committees tend to hire, you know, junior faculty that agrees ideologically or otherwise with their point of view. And as a result, what you have now in the majority of universities and colleges in America is a very left-wing, very woke kind of postmodern progressive faculty. Actually, I think about 2 days ago, there was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal showing us the data in terms of who actually gets hired and how that replication process goes on.
You're painting a picture of especially the college experience the last couple decades. And I was thinking of another story that broke this week, and that was that Dr. Seuss can no longer be read to preschoolers because it's not woke enough, it's racist.
Cat in the Hat? Yeah. Oh, my word. So, nothing's sacred anymore.
What about the Grinch, right?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
But the thing was, Dr. Seuss for generations has painted a story to children in language they can understand, of that we are different. A person is a person no matter how small, from Horton Hears Who, to quote that. So we are now decided that those life stories and lessons that were so essential starting in preschool, we're throwing those out too. So I think it's gotten a lot worse even from where you were back in the 80s when you were began teaching to this demographic, that now all the day we're pushing this process all the way down to the preschool level. And I just wonder, Doctor, at what point will our society start to push back on some of these elements? We laugh about them on social media and we say, oh, they're crazy. But the reality is we do not seem to have pushback, and thus they have entrenched even further and deeper into how our children are educated.
I wish I had a clear answer to this question, mm-hmm. Ellen. Last summer, I wrote an article about the cancel culture for the Wall Street Journal using Czeslaw Milosz, a brilliant Nobel Prize winner, a poet who actually escaped from communist Poland, and he experienced this kind of closing of someone's mind where you're forced to repeat lies, you're forced to repeat things that you know are not true, but they become the condition not just of you surviving, but being able to function in society. And what I find most disturbing, and I wrote that in that Wall Street Journal editorial, is that increasingly people sense that a sort of violence is being done to them in terms of what they're allowed to say, how they're supposed to respond, what they're allowed to express. But at the same time, they increasingly lack the language to frame that because the politically correct narrative is just smothering everything. The left does not engage in a debate anymore. It simply cancels you out. It throws you overboard. One of the greatest aspects of our democratic tradition has been this ability to engage in vigorous debate. Free speech means by definition the right to offend somebody who disagrees with that person, but it also means tolerance and respect so that you can have that back and forth conversation. And that's how truth is really found. It's by engaging, just like you engage with a biblical text or engage with any sort of work of history, by engaging with that text and testing your values and testing your ideas, you actually get to the truth, or at least as close as you can get to the truth. That has been the essence of Western political tradition. We're now in a situation where people are increasingly afraid to speak up. So when that piece came out, I had about 1,500 comments written at the end of the article. Then there were some, you know, articles written elsewhere denouncing me, of course, as irredeemable or whatever, which was fine. But the really painful aspect was when I started getting emails sent to me through our public affairs office, you know, from people who read that article, saying things like, sir, I am afraid that if I said something like what you just said, I would be fired. I would not be able to work. I would not be promoted. I would lose my income. I would lose my ability to function in the community. So when you ask, when will we start pushing back? I think it has to be done one conversation at a time. We live in a situation where the digital, you know, digital corporations, a digital aristocracy, if you will, that controls the access to the media, makes it more and more difficult for us to actually engage in the kind of public agora that is at the very foundation of American political tradition. I mean, if you can eliminate and shut down the president of the United States, whether you agree with him or not, that's immaterial here. But if you can simply say, no, he will have no access to the medium that is essentially a for-profit operation, then something has gone very, very wrong. I'm talking about Twitter, you know, censuring President Trump. Or if you have things flagged on social media, I had a colleague who posted the Twin Towers with just a little note, you know, remember on the anniversary of 9/11. And that was flagged as potentially offensive context. I mean, You see stuff like this and you go, what does an aneurysm feel like, right? That we have reached the point mm-hmm. where the freest nation on earth is self-censoring now or being censored in the process. So if you look at Dr. Seuss, which by the way is my family's favorite books. I mean, my daughter grew up on this. Even though my daughter is now an adult, every mm-hmm. Christmas we watch, you know, How Grinch Stole Christmas, and we cheer for the Who's in Whoville and whatever. Mm-hmm. We are stripping integral aspects of cultural memory that took generations to develop, and we're replacing it with nothing. We're replacing it with essentially a relativized, values-free, no guidance of any kind, no compass message to our young men and women, other than saying, do what you will, you know? I ask myself how those young men and women, when they go into adulthood, and I don't want to sound like an old man complaining, but when they go into adulthood, what value set are they going to pass on to their children, to their families, and what our educational system will look like? I looked at some studies recently. It's really interesting the extent to which every successive generation in America seems to feel that it has to control and monitor its speech, that the free exchange of ideas, and I mean free within the boundaries of civilized discourse, right? I mean, there's a reason why you're not allowed to scream fire in the movie theater, because that is something completely different. I'm talking about exchanging views with people. And this goes back to this kind of attempt of, I am going to destroy you. Our discourse used to be, okay, you win the argument, I lose the argument, we will engage again, and we will continue. The kind of quintessential American idea of compromise and the quintessential mother's milk of politics. Our discourse is now what I would call the Leninist type of discourse. Lenin wrote a little brochure when he was working on the Russian Revolution entitled Kto Kavo, who's going to get whom, meaning I win, you disappear. It's not I win, you lose. I win and you get canceled. I actually experienced this very early on, already in the mid-90s, when I was talking to a doctoral fellow at the Hoover Institution. She was doing some research on English socialism, and we engaged in some discussion about class, race, American politics, and this very delightful young woman who was charming, halfway through our conversation, which I thought was very measured, said to me, you're nothing but an upper middle class white male, and she walked away. And I thought, that is the indictment of where our culture is heading. You don't engage with the argument, you simply slap the identity label of a given group on somebody and you discount anything that person has to say. I will conclude by saying this, what an impoverished way of interacting with the world around you. If all you see is skin color, gender, you know, some class identity, you don't see the human being behind it. And I think that's what we need to bring back into our educational processes. We need to allow young men and women to rediscover the individual behind all that nonsense about group identities.
You know, absolutely. You're talking about impoverishment. Now, most of the Generation Zers are what they call digital natives. So they have grown up on the internet. They have grown up on the screen. It is easy to be very polemical when you are a distance away. It is easy to hurl insults and to be nasty when you're not doing that face to face. So I wonder, and there's got to be a reason for this. And if this is not being generated from this strictly internet culture where, you know what, it doesn't allow for personal dialogue. It doesn't allow for a face-to-face meeting. You can just write your screech and walk away, and you're not doing it to a person, you're doing it to a screen. So I wonder how much of that has actually bled into now our culture. So the screen has almost in a way become our culture.
I will actually take what you said one step further. I think the internet culture has created a degree of chaos that is just unprecedented. The constant stimulation, the constant, you know, I have to be connected. Things that my daughter right now is in DC. So the fact that I can reach out to her at any minute and we can feel like we're doing this right now with Ellen out of the US, that was absent when I was growing up. That's not a part of that. You know, you called your parents, you interacted differently. And I think we have not yet matured enough in our ability to handle the medium. So the social media gives young men and women a sense of anonymity to some degree. You can create whatever, you know, avatar you want of yourself and call yourself whatever you want. It gives you supposedly a kind of ability to hide behind that screen, whereas in reality, since we work on a lot of cyber issues here at the Marshall Center, you could be just standing and screaming every bit of information about yourself if you're in an open internet environment, and that information is being harvested and sold. You don't even realize that you're doing that. And then also the vulgarity of the interaction. That I find absolutely stunning. I met Senator Moynihan when he retired. I was at the Wilson Center at that time. And Senator Moynihan, who was, you know, a very crusty liberal, you know, smart guy, he said, "We've defined deviancy down. What used to be the standard has vanished. What used to be the gutter is now the standard." And I've always remembered that. And with every passing generation, when I think I've seen it all, I am stunned. I am sometimes genuinely surprised by the vitriol and the vocabulary and the lack of respect for another person. And that's interesting because it's for a generation that's being taught that how they feel about something is really what matters. I cannot tell you how many times in seminar I would have a student saying, "But I feel that that's how it should be." Not a logical argument that you get to something. You know, it seems to me, and that somehow has to be respected. I call this undisciplined learning. This is untempered minds that enter college, go through college, even through graduate school, and emerge as confused and as angry and as unable to launch into adulthood. If you look at the number of men and women, and it's also true about Europe, who are increasingly not launching into adulthood by the time they're 35. If they haven't done anything professional by the time they're 35, they're pretty much going to kind of float from then on. Very seldom do you have people who pull themselves together. And that's increasingly the norm that we're seeing. That breeds the sense of anxiety, anger. And of course, the ready-made explanation is the system did it to you. Structural racism, structural gender oppression, structural, all this other nonsense that you hear up there. And I find it striking that very few adults, and maybe because the adults are increasingly the products of that educational system.
We've been speaking with Dr. Andrew A. Mikta. He's the Dean of the College of International and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center in Germany. Thanks for joining us today.
Ladies, it's been my honor. Thank you very much.
For Michelle McAloon, I'm Ellen Taylor, and we will speak to you the next time on Convergence.